And now, your Chilpack Hollywood Hour with Dean Haglund and Phil Lairness.
Phil, Dean, what will it be today? Now intercontinental, LA to Australia. It's your Chilpack Hollywood Hour. It's your Chilpack Hollywood Hour.
That is true. You would think that after this many years, we would be so good at this that we could record a one-hour show in like 8-9 minutes tops. Oh, look at that. We're recording. Hey, everybody. I'm Phil Lairness. Down under, this is Mujahideen Dean Haglund. How are you, Dean?
I am exhausted, but fantastic. Let's go with that.
Okay. This is your Chilpack Hollywood Hour. Dean, you are exhausted because, let me guess... Don't give it away. You're exhausted because the annual Independence Day, American Independence Day, 4th of July celebrations have already begun down there in Sydney.
As you know, I am also Canadian, so the numerous expats that live in Australia celebrated Canada Day here. However, that's not why. It was because I hosted the Melbourne Web Fest annual award show, and followed by the after parties, plural, that went to 4:38 in the morning for me. Everyone else continued, I'm sure, till sunup.
Now, okay, a few questions for you.
Okay, yeah.
First of all, you hosted the after parties, or you attended the after parties?
I attended the after parties. I hosted the award show.
Okay, right.
Right. That's a big difference. Which was live streamed. You could have watched it if you were.
Oh, didn't up I? At, didn't
at
I? Watch
6,
it?
4 a.m. 4 a.m. your time.
So, WebFest. And this is a prestigious awards show hosting gig.
Yes. And yes, it's kind of a big deal in Australia.
What was your affiliation that they would think, get me that guy that appears occasionally on Sydney's Studio 10 morning show?
Well, I'm also an actor in a web series down here called Shakespeare Republic.
This is what I was
online.
Trying to get to, because you really haven't spoken of this.
It's true. I think somehow web series have flown under my radar for too long now. Even though I've been in one, I didn't realize the impact and the quality of these things that are seen around the world. So Shakespeare Republic, of course, is a series about taking Shakespearean monologues and rearranging them to create a new narrative, which is kind of cool. And this is produced and directed by Sally McLean, who Australian raconteur who's trained in London as a Shakespearean actor. And she is also one of the executive directors of the Melbourne Web Fest, which is how I got to host that thing.
So did Shakespeare Republic win any of the big awards?
Well, last year it did. This year it couldn't because she's on the executive committee, and therefore you're ineligible to show your own web series if you are running the WebFest. Which,
that undoubtedly is different than how things would run in America.
totally.
But who do you play? Now, so it takes the monologues and it works in a new pre-existing monologues and works them into a new narrative. And
right.
It's an ongoing narrative from
That's
episode
correct.
To episode. And do you play one character, or a la Shakespeare's times, do you play multiple characters?
Well, right now I play one character. I do a Iago monologue, which then is put into a larger context that you have to watch the whole series to figure out.
So you play Iago?
Yes. I do my Iago treacherous planning monologue. And, you know, I serve him to serve myself sort of thing.
I mean, this is the Shakespearean character. Quite honestly,
Exactly.
And
it's a classic.
I would say you got Iago and you got Lear. I mean, maybe you put Lady Macbeth in there, but this is as good as it gets. I mean, people think, the name of the play is Othello, but the role is Iago. And
that's exactly right.
You know, and you think of Hamlet. Hamlet is not the role. I mean, Hamlet is somebody who can't make up his mind versus, let's say, King Lear, who's someone who's looking back on a whole life and ruining every decision ever made. That's
exactly
a role. And by the way, did you see Glenda Jackson playing Lear on Broadway? It's supposed to be phenomenal.
I bet.
I mean, that's the role. And that's also, by the way, I was talking about this weekend. One of the things that you love about the theater, right, is you're allowed to get old. you're allowed to grow old. Yeah. And in fact, not only are you allowed to, you want to, because all the great roles are written for older people.
Older.
Who have lifetime of experience to call upon. Isn't that amazing?
I always love when the British press will review a young Shakespearean actor and say, I cannot wait till he's old enough to do the Lears and the Othellos and all of those things.
Yeah.
It's always so exciting to go, I can't wait for that actor to get old enough and get the experience to really get to some theater.
Of course, if the writer, the reviewer, knows how great those roles are, it means they are older than the actor they're writing about. Which means they ain't going to be around to see it in the first place.
Of course.
That's how it works, people.
Oh, sad.
So, that's exciting. That was exciting. Was it fun hosting your show?
Oh, my God. Fun and inspiring. Good. Look, so much creativity. And, you know, because of, ironically, the same night the Australian Television Awards are going on up at the Gold Coast, which they unfortunately called the Logies. Don't ask me. I know. Anybody who hears that has the same snicker. The way television works here, it's a bit of a closed shop. So there's actually money and government financing available for web series down here, as opposed to you kind of shouldering it all yourself in the dark. Up there, so the quality of the Australian web series.
In the dark, it has to be done in the dark in the U.S. Under cover of darkness, you don't let anyone know you're working on a web series. You have to do it under cover of darkness.
Let me explain something to you. How about a press blackout? A press blackout?
Yeah, that comes that comes with the territory. Exactly. You don't have to try to fly under the radar. The web series are already under the radar. Yes. Okay.
Exactly. Except here, they actually have some, you know, excitement and momentum and production values, and it's thrilling to see and inspiring. That's all.
Great. Excellent.
Yes.
All right. Well, Dean Haglund, where can people find Shakespeare Republic? I mean, again, you've never promoted this. Where can they find it?
I'm so embarrassed. You can find it online at shakespeare republic.com. That's an easy one. That's its whole website, and all the episodes are up there. And then from there, it's sent to other platforms where you can watch many other web series from around the world, including some that I'm going to catch up on. Including a French one called Alice in Paris, a woman with the superpowers to taste food. So, you know, that's good.
What? The superpower to taste food? Well, we all have that superpower.
Yeah, I know, but she has her taste buds are highly refined, like a superpower.
Like she doesn't have to put it in her mouth.
Yes, he can just feel the bread. And
like, she doesn't have to be there. She doesn't have to be there.
Right. I think you're misinterpreting that.
See,
yeah.
I actually feel like my go-to superhero power that I always have said that I wanted actually lends itself, an offshoot of it is an enhanced sense of taste. And of course, that was always the ability to smell into the future. So...
Well, that allows you to leave the room if someone has the terrible...
Or at least a few seconds in advance before anybody knows why, you get to say it wasn't me. All right.
Wow. That is a good superhero. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah.
What are we doing today? This is an exciting show.
We got to open. We got to open up the Chill Pack Morgue.
Celebrity deaths.
Harlan Ellison, noted futurist. Harlan Ellison. I still have no idea what the phrase noted futurist means. I know what a futurist is, and I know what it is to be noted. I still don't know what the phrase noted futurist means, because the only time I have ever heard the phrase noted futurist is in front of the name Harlan Ellison, and I've been hearing it all my goddamn life. Noted futurist Harlan Ellison, and dare I say, angry miscreant Harlan Ellison has shuffled off his angry, mean mortal coil.
Mean?
Not a fan, not a beloved figure of the Me Too movement. A history of bad behavior in his wake. But let's talk about Harlan Ellison. Were you a fan of Harlan Ellison's writing, Dean Haglund?
I was. The few things that I saw, of course, I grew up with his long-lost TV sci-fi series called Star Lost, a ship of individual pods that have individual cultures on him, and a guy discovering it. And this was apparently Harlan Ellison's very first work that he was so embarrassed and hated that he had his name removed from it. But if you watch Star Lost, you'll realize this is the beginning of Harlan Ellison's future vision.
And this is a recurring theme. Harlan Ellison getting pissed off and taking his name off things, regardless of quality, right? He writes the best episode of Star Trek, of any of the Star Trek series, that really cements what Star Trek is capable of doing. A masterful hour of television. Wins a Writers Guild Award for this episode, by the way. Not just sci-fi awards, a Writers Guild of America award for writing an hour-long episode of science fiction television for The City on the Edge of Forever. And tries to disown himself from it every moment thereafter, including when he's accepting all these awards for it, about how it was butchered. I mean, in the most angry, ungrateful terms imaginable, how it was butchered and how very little of it was allowed to survive. There is no sense at any time in any of Harlan Ellison's numerous rants about this that filmmaking should be collaborative in any way.
Wow. I didn't, you know, I guess I did not follow Harlan Ellison closely enough to know this streak of rage that underlied all his noted futurist work.
Really? Did you find his writing to be particularly hopeful and humane?
Well, no. Oh, clearly, you know, when Joan Collins gets run over, that's terrible. But yeah, I guess it wasn't hopeful. Now you point that out. Well, Star Lost had a sense of hope to it, but that was his first piece.
And maybe why he's still young. And he took his name off of it.
That's right. Oh, yeah. Okay, yeah. Now that's
But I will
sense.
Say that okay. You made Star Lost sound really interesting. I mean, this is, you got me to watch the other space, right? That Yahoo series, and now you're going to get me to find Star Lost. And by the way, I still, like a week doesn't go by that I'm not passing in the neighborhood a cast member, different cast members all the time from other space. I mean, it's
Is
just,
that right?
And it's such a big deal for me, and I don't bring it up because inevitably I'm with someone and they haven't heard of it, and you know, anyway, it just seems, but it's such
I wish I could find that again. Yahoo collapsed their television platform.
I wish they had brought it back. I mean, it really was very, very funny, but it's star lost for me. So also cooling his heels over here in the Chilpak morgue is Joe Jackson. And when I heard Joe Jackson had died, I was shocked that shoeless Joe Jackson from the Chicago Black Sox scandal of 1919, discredited ball player, was still alive. Good for him.
No.
And then it turns out, no. You're thinking wrong field. It's not sports. It's music. And I, of course, was brokenhearted. The singer of Steppin' Out. Is dead. Who had contributed so mightily to William Shatner's Has Been album? No. It's not him. It's Michael Jackson's dad, the patriarch of the Jackson family. To which we can always say good riddance and about time, I guess we can say.
Yeah. You know, anyone, I sort of, whatever space I was giving him, it was kind of tough when he was promoting his websites at Michael Jackson's funeral for his camera interviews. You're a bit disconnected. From your family.
What is the amount of abuse of some kind, whether it be physical, emotional, what have you? It doesn't really matter. What is the amount and the intensity and the duration of the abuse that would cause virtually all your children to undergo so much transformative surgery that they resemble you not a whit, so that in some cases they indeed even change their skin color so that they not be an offspring of their father anymore. I mean, it's startling. That was the day that I really witnessed, was I go, oh man, they really don't. Because they all did at one point look like him. They looked like their dad. Anyway, I mean, he was patriarch and matriarch are words that seem in many ways to go by the wayside. But when a powerful family finds the center of its power in a mother or a father, I mean, that is what we mean. And it's part of a largely a bygone age, right? But boy, he created an empire through his children, did he not?
Did he not? And you know, finding opportunities for young talent to grow, I suppose, whether they wanted to or not, that was sort of the Jackson Five.
Whether they wanted to or not. I mean, it's interesting, you know, and it's kind of in the tradition of these, what's the word? Not impresario, but, impresario in part, but also kind of Svengali-like figures. I often think of, right, Colonel Tom Parker, under whose sway Elvis Presley found himself. I was hearing a lecture on the director, Michael Curtiz, right, who everybody knows for Casablanca, but who directed about 180 feature films in his career, and many of them are classics. I mean, you've got Casablanca, you've got Yankee Doodle Dandy, you've got Mildred Pierce, and he worked with Elvis. He directed Elvis and Kid Creole. And Kid Creole, if you ever get a chance to see it, or you know, or maybe you remember but Elvis's performance is quite interesting. It's quite promising of an actor who could eventually be the real deal. And apparently, Curtiz tells the story about how that's what Elvis wanted. Elvis thought, my future is as an actor, because I don't know if me continuing to play rock and roll as I mature makes a lot of sense. So I would like to be an actor. I'd like, this is the art form I want to explore further. And of course, it was Colonel Tom that put a kibosh on that. And as soon as Elvis was back from the army, Elvis was allowed to do movies, but he had to play the same character again and again and again. Yeah. Of course, it was a watered down, harmless version of the Elvis that had come before, a family friendly version of the Elvis that had come before, and he had to play him again and again and again. But it really was the age, the era of these kind of Svengali figures who drove so much of the development of popular music history.
True, right? And because they also developed the forms of, you know, the large stage tour, how it's marketed, how albums get into record stores. A lot of that came from the power that these people held as a gateway to the talent. So a lot of that shaping, good or bad, that has left us with however crappy music is now based on marketing and the same machinations that are in film went to music a long time ago, it seems.
A couple weeks back, Dean, you and I did a two-part episode all about our all-time favorite comedy films. Do you remember that?
We sure did. Yeah, that was fun.
We were so much younger then. And and our best days were still ahead of us. Anyway, we heard about those shows in a couple of emails that I shared last week from our loyal listener, Maurice Terenzio. And Maurice followed up this week, and he mentioned in his email a comedy team that actually... I was glad that he did, because I've long wanted to bring them up. I am not familiar with them, but as such a student of early cinema and of comedy, I was really curious as to whether you were familiar with them. And it's the comedy team of Wheeler and Woolsey.
Yes.
And he brought them up because they were the stars of one of those shows we mentioned, one of those movies that Maurice brought up last week, Diplomaniacs, when he was writing about the films that had similarities to Duck Soup. So they were very, very popular with the untimely passing of Robert Woolsey in 1938 at the age of 50. The team kind of slipped into obscurity. But 20 of their 21 feature films are available on DVD, excuse me. And during their heyday, which was 1929 to 1937, so the first 8 years really of sound films, they were huge box office successes and a great fan favorite. And this film, Diplomaniacs, according to Maurice, is not among their best work, but it was a huge, financial success. It was really, really popular. So what do you know about them?
Well, I remember that team. Woolsey, of course, if I'm not mistaken, the guy with the round glasses like Harold Lloyd, so easily identifiable in the movies. They, of course, there was that weird transition for comedy from the silent era where it was physical gags, high, 18 frames per second. You were slowing it down, making everything fast and jittery and manic and crazy. And then when sound came in, none of that worked anymore. That was considered old fashioned. So you looked for comedy acts that were verbose, that had one-liners, that were doing, hence the Marx Brothers and these guys. And so they would do kind of the old vaudeville, say Woolsey, what did I know, that kind of thing, and had sort of one-liners and gags at that point. I'm trying to think if I know anything off the top that I can remember.
The other film that Maurice wrote us about, Girl Crazy, was also one of theirs. So I'm doubly intrigued now to check these films out,
I mean, they have a very classic feel of a vaudeville dual act, that there's sort of a one's not right and one's you can't do that. They've set up a conflict and two very diverse characters that play off each other pretty well. And I could see that Burt Wheeler, kind of needed Woolsey because it seemed Woolsey was doing all the punchlines. And it was tough then for once that your comedy partner dies for you to go on as a single act.
The other thing that I need to mention to you, because maybe he can write you directly to ask for advice in this. I heard that Maurice has undergone arthroscopic surgery on his meniscus because he has arthritis, and it's no small thing. These knee surgeries, are they, Dean Haglund?
Even though they say microscopic, it's actually a big deal. Yeah. No, I'm now an official trumpeter, a flag bearer of the knee surgery, the TKR. But meniscus replacement and ACL, I'm also well experienced. So yes, please shoot me an email and we can discuss at length pre, post, and current.
What could be
post-operative?
What could be more fun?
Exciting?
What could be more
yeah,
fun?
Yeah, nothing. I can't think of a thing.
Hey, I mentioned last week that I was so excited about Westworld season 2 coming to a conclusion.
Yes.
And it's interesting because the ratings were down this year, much less viewership. And I had to admit that I understood why. That from Lily to our friend Lee McCloskey and others, that the violence of season 2, the unremitting violence of it, was too much for them.
Right.
And it is interesting. I don't know how they necessarily avoid that, because it's part and parcel maybe to the themes of it, but it's too bad. I feel that they lost. It's understandable that people didn't want to watch it. I get it. And I think it's too bad that maybe the show couldn't configure a way to keep that audience, because it was a very fascinating season. You know, season 1 was all about the development of the bicameral mind, about the achieving of consciousness. And and season 2 was, you know, all about the concept of free will. Does it exist? And not just can it exist for the advent of a truly conscious artificial intelligence, but then does that consciousness come with it any type of free will at all? And indeed, is there any kind of free will for humans? There's a wonderful, wonderful line where the system says, I was motivated to try to find out why humans make the decisions that they made. And after millions of experiments, I suddenly realized, oh, they don't. They don't make the decisions that they make.
Right.
Anyway, so a show with so much on its mind, and again, one that leaves me really excited about how they will open up and where they will go with season 3. And might I add, any TV show that lets you watch Jeffrey Wright every week...
every week
is something to savor, is an opportunity to savor, because that is a guy that can't work enough, quite frankly.
I know. I just rewatched Basquiat.
I would imagine that you don't really talk about that, but I would imagine that is a film that you particularly, of all people, love.
I you know, directed by Julian Schnabel, whose artwork I appreciate, even though I understand the plates are falling off the canvas now. His fractured ceramic series is maybe not having the long life one would hope, but certainly his vision and the quality of that thing, plus the life story and Jeffrey Wright's performance. So much about that movie requires a second or third look.
Right. Well, and you were a huge fan of his film Diving Bell and the Butterfly, Julian Schnabel.
Yes. So, yes. Remember, I think we did a whole episode on that one.
That maybe a few. I mean, it was that was an excellent, excellent
a big
movie.
Deal. Yeah.
So I hope you will catch up to give yourself a chance to watch these seasons of Westworld, because they really are up to some fascinating things, some, you know, really interesting topics, and it's full of you know, pleasures, especially, you know, getting to watch the likes of Anthony Hopkins and Jeffrey Wright and Ed Harris and several other wonderful character actors, really, you know, getting to do stuff that's worthy of them. And there's really complex three-dimensional female leads. And Evan Rachel Wood and Tandy Newton rarely have been given stuff that is worthy of them. And so it's inspiring to get to see that as well.
Well, now you've talked me into it.
Speaking of HBO, finally caught a film on HBO this week that I was really looking forward to when it was coming out, because you know I was a big fan of the first one. And it is the sequel, Kingsman: The Golden Circle.
Really?
Do you remember the original Kingsman?
Yes, with Colin, the Kingsman first movie.
Yeah, with Colin Firth and Taron Egerton. Yeah. Did you not enjoy that movie?
I loved that movie. It was so sparky and bright and fresh. Fresh ideas, a great villain.
The action was fun and funny and and exciting and clever and
nicely realized.
Kingsman: The Golden Circle, a 2 hour and 23 minute sequel. That feels twice as long. Has not a moment that is fresh, inventive, or funny. And it is a movie that manages to make Jeff Bridges, Channing Tatum, Halle Berry, to mention nothing of Colin Firth, and Mark Strong, and Taron Egerton, the lead, utterly uninteresting. And manages to make Julianne Moore a horrible, horrible actress.
I forgot, in fact, that Julianne Moore was in this. I saw this, not in the theater, but I think on an airplane.
You saw the sequel?
I saw the sequel.
How does the same director and the same writers come back based on the same source material and come up with this? I mean, this was the head scratcher sometimes in the James Bond world, right? How do they go from For Your Eyes Only, the same team, to A View to a Kill? There was a movie in between, this would happen, right? How does the team that make Goldfinger make You Only Live Twice? How does this happen? I am flabbergasted, and I'm not the hugest Matthew Vaughn fan. Sometimes I think his movies are terrible. Sometimes I think they're great. And this one is just dreadful.
Well, and for my mind, now this may be more movie executive bashing, but often you see in the sequel, it's not just the negative comments that can destroy a movie, but the positive comments. Oh my God. You think of Johnny Depp as Captain Sparrow.
I knew you would go there because it's kind of the textbook example of this. It has become that.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
That it feels like it's somebody so excited. We got to have more of that stuff I loved in the first one. Yeah. Everybody loves that thing or this action or that kind of level of violence. So let's put more of that in.
You are so right. I mean, I never thought about you. So what was great about, even though Kingsman is based on a graphic novel, what was great about Kingsman, the original one, was the way that they pushed off on recognizable tropes. And now they're not pushing off against anything. They're just trying to chase this bar they set for themselves.
Yeah, and that's so tough because I know for a fact that some executives are very sensitive to the fact that they're always considered negative Nellies, that they're always, saying this sucks and this, don't do that. So they're thrilled when they can be excited about something and be positive about what they loved in the first one and put more of that in the second one.
You kind of pointed out that this is a problem with Deadpool 2. Why Deadpool 2 doesn't have kind of the effort, seemingly, and we say effortless, but we know that Nothing requires more effort than making something come off as effortless. Nothing is harder work than that. But so the seemingly effortless nature of Deadpool, you feel Deadpool too working way too hard at times. You feel it. That said, as we've pointed out, these people are incredibly gifted and incredibly dedicated to joke construction. And they still had targets of interest. Maybe not as many, and maybe it's not fresh ground, so that's why, you know, they're getting into the trouble and you feel the hard work. And so maybe, a la what we just got from, you know, what we got from the Kingsman, maybe it's remarkable that Deadpool 2 was actually as good as it was.
Yeah. You know, you think about that, because how much, not just pressure, but, you know, expectations that you got to erase the expectations. It's such a zen golfing moment. You think of golfers who have once won many a PGA tour, suddenly have to erase that all in their mind, particularly if they played that course before, to approach it fresh and to clear their mind so that it is a direct relationship of muscle memory to connecting to the ball to getting it down the field. This is the exact same thing when creating a collaborative project like a movie, that you have to remove all of that chatter. And that chatter doesn't only exist in the creator's head and the performer's head. It's happening now outside with hangers on and people on set. And, you know, and it's not that nobody's doing it maliciously. They're doing it because they're excited and they say, oh, my God, I saw the first one. I love when you did blah, blah, blah as a compliment. But then that is inserted in your head to turn it into self-consciousness. Once you're in self-consciousness, you are screwed.
Well, it's kind of like from a performer standpoint, I would imagine. Wow, I mean, we could probably get into X-Files and Gunman, but what about as an example, Martin Freeman instead, and what he said about doing the Sherlock season series, and why he, you know, wasn't looking forward necessarily to there being another season of it, another year of it, another series, whatever you want to call it. Depending on what country you're in, why he's not looking forward to it is that kind of the fun is sucked out of it by the heavy expectation and ownership feelings that are expressed by the audience. And, and you know, it just, it takes all the fun out of it. And, and he pointed out that's kind of what the Beatles felt. And, to his end, Benedict Cumberbatch, when asked about Martin Freeman's comments, pointed out that Martin Freeman's an ass. Whereas I like to think that both men are right.
Well, yes.
You know?
Yeah, right.
But there really is something to say that. Yeah.
Absolutely. This is a thing I would, you know, if the press is asking me, I would never relate this because that's only going to exacerbate ownership, pressure, all of that, your inability to work on a project. So I'm glad we steered it away from the X-Files because absolutely to publicly announce these creative issues that come with something that is highly popular to make it more popular.
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to say, and I'm not going to ask you to comment on this, so I'm just going to say this. I would read comments from people, you know, asking, for example, after this episodes of this season of The X-Files, does Chris Carter understand how much the fans hate him right now? And I wanted to go to those people's houses and say, if you don't mind me saying so, fuck you. because, no, he's doing what he ought to be doing right now, which is he's finding the show that he wants to explore and he wants to tell. Right. That's his job want from him. And I felt that it was the job that he stepped away from and kind of forgot about a little bit in the first revival year, which was too much about what do fans want and how do we get there? Instead of what do I want to explore? This was why, many people who called themselves Twin Peaks fans were turned off by the recent season on Showtime because, according to them, it wasn't Twin Peaks. And there is no right or wrong about this, except in this case when those people are wrong, because it wasn't what they wanted. Right?
Right.
But there is no denying that Lynch and Frost went back to those parts of themselves from which the original ideas flowed. And they connected with that, and they explored that. And yes, it was different. We're decades on. These people who are doing the exploration are different people, but they connected with Source. There's no doubt in my mind about that. And of course, it came out different.
I agree with that.
As it should, right? A painter such as yourself connecting with Source again and again and again throughout the years may find themselves painting in entirely different styles. But that doesn't mean that they've become a different, quote-unquote, painter. They're still the same artist. They're still committed to exploring Source with the same authenticity and the same integrity.
Absolutely. You look at early Renoirs and later Renoirs, they seem by two different artists, and yet the exploration of a career of an artist will transmute. One would hope that one changes, at least, or one is one affected by the context of the sociological phenomena that is living day to day in this world.
Well, as an aside on this, because I brought up David Lynch, of course, David Lynch caused waves about some comments taken out of context that he made about the president when he said President Trump could go down in history as one of the greatest presidents. and this, I mean, no less than our friend Marina Sirtis retweeted this and said, well, I guess I have to, unfortunately, stop ever watching any David Lynch work ever again. and this, to me, is a fundamental problem, first of all, that we can't enjoy the work of an artist because of what their political expressions are. Really? We can't.
Really?
This is different than, you know what, I can't put my money and time towards supporting Roseanne because clearly she is a racist. That is a different thing. You know, I can't put my money and time towards watching Roman Polanski movies because I don't want him to have the opportunity to work anymore, because when he does, he tends to exploit the people and assault the people that are trusting him. So that's a different thing, right? But the other thing about it is this kind of shows the importance of, as artists, really keeping your mouth shut, because we live at a time when everything's taken out of context and nobody's going to bother to listen to. And the explanation that he had was, you know, was a really thoughtful one, which was what he meant was this guy has disrupted things so much that what could come out of it could end up being a rebuilding of our government and our institutions in a way that respond to and serve the people better than they did before. And this gets back to our conversation, like immediately following the election, when I actually got this feeling, and I have it still, that the legacy of the Trump years might, in fact, somewhat ironically, be to make America great again, because so many people have realized it's our job to do that, to make America great. It's not the job of our government to do it.
Right. Yes. And how that idea got into our head dates back to the 50s, I suppose. But yes, the awakening, the arousal of participation in terms of not just demonstrations, but within the voting and stuff like that.
See, you
brings us fall back.
Despite the fact that you have such blind spots that lead to animosity towards David Lynch, you would, because of who you are, you actually have, I have this feeling that if I asked you on a weekly basis a question about Lynch's work and didn't let you know who it was or what it was I was talking about, you would have the most incredible insights, because you just brought up how this idea goes back to the 50s and suddenly a major penny dropped for me. You know, David Lynch has often gone back to 50s culture in his work.
Absolutely. And, in his movie, in Twin Peaks.
Oh, well, Blue Velvet.
The diner.
Blue Velvet, right? The white picket fence things, America, and how the dark undercurrent and the underbelly of it is the corruption of our own ability to explore our own lives and to create our own sense of franchise. And that's a major theme that he explores, how the promises we're given culturally tend to enslave us in some ways and tend to reduce us in some ways. So anyway, the point is that, you know, again, it's really sad when we let our knee-jerk be, oh my God, they said that. I can't watch this person's work anymore, because the only person you're hurting is you when you do that. Yeah.
So, yes, as I always bring up, you don't go look at the Mona Lisa anymore. When you go to Paris, you're supporting a 14th century child molester named Leonardo da Vinci. And if you don't deny that, if you're going to extend that from now, extend that back to the Renaissance and the taking of an 8-year-old from a farm field to be his air quote apprentice.
I think the more relevant comparison would be I'm not going to read this particular poet from the 1930s because they turned out to be a socialist.
Right. I mean, so yeah.
Yeah. So it doesn't matter how good their work makes me feel. It's a socialist who's making me feel that way. What you were saying earlier about expectations, right?
Yes.
And this is, you know, part and parcel of it. The expectations we now impose upon those whose work brings us joy, which is so odd that we feel entitled to impose expectations on the people who bring us joy, of all people. And and you know, getting back to movies, right? This is why it's crazy that we make sequels, right? We're giving the people what they want because we're giving them sequels, but the expectations on these things makes it fool's gold. I was actually kind of amused by this sequel to the Oceans series, the all-female series.
All-female, yes, Ocean's Eight.
Have you seen this?
No, I haven't, and I'm, you know, curious to actually see it.
I was curious to see it, and I was made all the more so after reading our friend Erin Petrulis's thoughts about it.
Because
she said, if you have ever wanted to see a movie that is 100% completely conflict-free, utterly free of conflict, if that's how you like your movies, this is the movie for you. And it's incredible because she's absolutely right. Here is a caper film, a crime film, and there is no jeopardy and no conflict whatsoever. It is an utterly pleasant 2 hours of watching everything work out.
Wow. Well, see, don't you want that once in your life?
The only things that went wrong were the backstory of the film. Not at all in the film itself. It's stunning. It's an utterly harmless way to spend some time.
Wow. So, wait a sec. Utterly harmless.
Yeah, so those of you who believe that, you know, story is conflict and conflict is drama.
Right.
Well, you're right. And so this is neither dramatic nor a story. It's it's a perfect empty concoction, much like the popcorn.
Now, do you think this came from going, maybe they had written one where things go wrong, and then somebody goes, well, are you saying women can't do these things? Is this a political?
I don't know. There's no enemy.
Dial?
There's no enemy. There's no opponent. There's no. In the third act, they bring James Corden in to play an insurance investigator, and he is funny as hell. And again, it's so heartbreaking to me every time I get to see James Corden act that he's on television on a nightly basis, ruining TV. As a host,
right?
Because this guy was born to be an actor, and
he was.
And
I saw him on Broadway in that improvised thing.
Oh.
Yeah.
Not One Man, Two Governors.
Yeah, One Man, Two Governors. But there was lots of improv moments in there, particularly when people were handing him sandwiches off stage.
But again, there's no sense of jeopardy in it. He's some comic relief and another tool to make everything work out. You know, so it's this crazy thing of like act one, we want to do this and here are the things that went wrong in my past. Act two,
right.
Here's us doing the thing. And act three is here's also what was going right that you didn't notice because everything else was going right.
Okay, so there had to been a script that didn't do that, I would think. And then the rewrites met to expectations. I don't know.
So many other movies that I want to talk to you about.
Let's talk about them.
One that I think I mentioned last week when we were sharing notes on Coco, the 46-year-old gorilla who had left us.
The sign language. Yeah.
And I think I may have mentioned that Coco, figures prominently in a section in this documentary about Fred Rogers called "Won't You Be My Neighbor." And
right.
And this is from Morgan Neville, the Oscar-winning documentarian who made 20 Feet from Stardom. This focuses on Mr. Rogers and the making of a show, Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. And it is such the movie we need right now, because here is a man who was in the seminary. You know, he was graduating from the seminary. He was an ordained minister.
Right.
And he first sees television when he takes a break from the seminary to go back and visit his parents. And that's the first time he sees television. And the moment he sees television, he says, oh, well, this is going to be my church. And he is really the first televangelist. Every episode was to him a sermon, only he did it without a caller and without any biblical references.
How about that, right?
Isn't that interesting?
Exactly. There's neighborly love in there, and he's being thoughtful, considering he's having all the aspects of charity and everything that one should embrace if one is following the doctrine.
This is a man who, there's some great footage of him filming, coming out of retirement to film these PSAs in the wake of 9/11 and what to tell children about in the wake of that. And the footage is amazing because you see him at the piano and you really see a man who no longer believes that anything he can say will make a difference at all. He has lived long enough to doubt whether he has helped things at all. And indeed, he dies of cancer, and that's not surprising to me given the world that, given how painful the world was to him, because what made him such a brilliant communicator was he never lost touch with the frightened, pained child that he was. So he always understood that in other children and how to communicate with it. And and it's amazing because, he dies and immediately you have, voices on Fox News like you still do, referring to him as an evil man. And, and it's like really of all people. But that's the world that we're in because they disagreed with what they perceived to be the political message of this lifelong Republican and conservative, by the way, which, again, welcome to the world that we're in. For much of the Republican Party, the only thing worse you can be than a Democrat is apparently a Republican, right? Like, like Bob Mueller. I feel like they would hate Robert Mueller far less if he actually was a Democrat. But anyway,
how ironic.
It's really a stunning documentary, and just how much we need Fred Rogers more than ever. And, maybe those of us who were raised in no small part on his sermons on daily television who were made to feel less scared. And I was one of these kids who was made to feel less scared and less alone and made to feel understood in some ways. Maybe I need to make sure that I walk through the world embodying all the more the lessons that I learned from
Mr. Rogers. One would hope that that ripple in the pond that he made doubt it had had an effect. I think, I talked to many people who seem to at times pull an aspect of their personality that is a direct result of Mr. Rogers.
I saw another film that staggered me in terms of how much I loved it, because despite the fact that it got great reviews, it is directed by Paul Schrader. Now, Paul Schrader is one of the great writers of all time, right? Taxi Driver, right. Yep. Raging Bull, Last Temptation of Christ, all for Scorsese. Mm-hmm. Director of Hardcore, which I think is an underrated film. One of the reasons it's underrated is that the lead in it, George C. Scott, who's brilliant, didn't think Paul Schrader could direct. Schrader made Autofocus, right? Which is an interesting film.
Oh, yeah.
He made the Oscar-winning movie Affliction. But he is, I think rightly so up till now, considered something of a hack when it comes to being a director, especially in the wake of his last seven films, which included Dominion, an Exorcist prequel, and that movie with Lindsay Lohan, The Canyons. Remember that?
Oh, yeah.
From a couple of years ago? Yeah, that couldn't even get into any festivals. And all right. So, but he has a movie in theaters now called A First Reformed. And it is about Ethan Hawke as a Reformation Church priest, a former veteran of modern conflicts, whose marriage fell apart after the death of their son in one of these foreign conflicts. And he's the pastor at a tiny little kind of antique Reformation church. And while ministering to some of his flock, he becomes aware of their concern over what is happening to our environment. And this becomes his passion. He himself might be dying of a cancer. And the question then becomes, what is his role? How does he remain faithful to God? And what does it mean? Shouldn't he protect and be faithful to God's creation, no matter the cost? And it is a fascinating, disturbing film. His superior at the ministry is played by the really brilliant Cedric the Entertainer.
What? Did you say the really brilliant Cedric the Entertainer?
He's fantastic in this movie. Just fantastic.
Are you kidding me? That's amazing.
As a preacher and politician, though maybe more the latter than the former. This is a dark film. This is a metaphoric film, an allegorical film, a sometimes surrealistic film. It is mostly very well directed. It is perfectly written. It's one of the best scripts he's ever written. And Ethan Hawke is really a solid actor. And it's released from A24, the distribution company that I hold in the highest esteem possible, who have been releasing so many of the great movies of late. It's worthy counter-programming this summer, and it's a film that is going to be in the discussion for best films of the year and on many top 10 lists. First Reformed. Another film that I wanted to ask you about, and whether or not you've caught this, a couple of genre films, and we might go a few minutes over because we're not going to get the chance, I guess, next week to talk about these. But one is a science fiction action film from Australia, directed by the original Saw writer Lee Whannell. It's his sophomore directorial effort. It stars Logan Marshall Green. It's set in an unspecified future, and it's called Upgrade.
Oh, you know, I saw the trailer for this, had not had a chance to catch this thing. Tell me, what did you think?
Now, I loved like early to mid 80s sci-fi actioners. I loved them, right? And I think time has really kind of caught up to them and realized these were pretty good, you know?
Everything
from John Carpenter's, like Escape from New York to, you know, the Don Opper film Android, right? There were so many of these great, modestly budgeted sci-fi actioners that had some interesting satirical bite and some interesting thematic ideas on their mind.
Right.
And, exactly. And this is a worthy throwback to that kind of filmmaking. In fact, often it feels musically, texturally, that did they make this in the 1980s? And and yet it is clearly thematically and technologically a product of right now. It's set in a near, like I said, unspecified future where someone who has a horrible accident is paralyzed, left paralyzed after a horrible accident, is implanted with something called STEM, which is an artificial intelligence, which is able to bridge the gap in communication between the brain and the extremities. It is an artificial, what would you say, a cure for the spinal system and an electronic spur between them. And he becomes somewhat of a superhero. It's very RoboCop, actually. And indeed, he is motivated to continue to live, to go after the people that caused his accident in the first place. Someone very near and dear to him dies in that accident. And so that's his main reason for living, is to track those people down. And a la RoboCop, he now has the wherewithal to do it. And like RoboCop, we are left really questioning how we can ever trust the technology, right? So it's, I think you would really enjoy this movie. Upgrade from V1L.
Okay. I'm going to look for that one whenever it shows up. What else is on the list?
Finally, another genre film that was released to great acclaim and to great fanfare. And I want to talk about the film, and then I want to set future conversation with a topic arising out of it. This is a horror film called Hereditary. Have you seen the...
Yes. Now that is on my list.
It's on your list because the advertising is terrific.
Yeah.
Okay.
Sure is. Yeah. The trailer looked fascinating.
The marketing materials and what you read about it.
Yeah.
And this
you
is a film.
You try to escape your dark fate.
This is a film that was released to extraordinary reviews. I think it's 90% positive reviews on Rotten Tomatoes. And this is a film where you can feel from the advertising, ooh, like the best horror films of the last several years, and there's so many great ones. As I have said, I feel like horror films have been saving the soul of cinema.
And this has Toni Collette and Gabriel Byrne for
great actors, a film that is clearly up to something allegoric, right? And it's the feature film debut from Ari Aster. It also stars some young performers who are really quite interesting. Alex Wolff and Tony Award winner Millie Shapiro, who was on Broadway in Matilda. This is her first movie. The basic premise, when Ellen passes away, her daughter's family begins to unravel cryptic and increasingly terrifying secrets about their ancestry. The more they discover, the more they find themselves trying to outrun the sinister fate they seem to have inherited. I mean, not only is that a great premise, but you can tell it is a movie about something, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And boy, would you be wrong. Boy, if you think that the 90% positive reviews mean this thing is good, no, you know what this is a throwback to? Those days when you knew if a horror film got good reviews, it wasn't remotely scary. Because who doesn't like to be fooled? Film critics don't like to be fooled. They like to be smarter than the movie, and this is a movie you are always smarter than. If you have seen Rosemary's Baby, you have seen the best that this film has to offer, and you will walk out pissed off that you didn't just watch Rosemary's Baby. And let me remind people who have seen it, If you thought Rosemary's Baby was scary, watch it again and you will wonder why you ever thought that it was scary. It's funny, but it's not scary. And
well, the rooms where everybody's staring at her, that's, well, I guess that's not really scary.
So I leave Hereditary with this. This is a horror film where 90% of the audience, I mean 90% of the critics gave it positive reviews, but only 56% of the people who supposedly went to see it have enjoyed it. That is a huge drop-off. You expect critics to like some films more than audiences will. For example, that Ethan Hawke film that I told you about, First Reformed, going to be a shock to you that 96% of critics liked it, but only 72% of the people who saw it liked it. We expect this. It's an art house film, right?
Right. That's how it goes.
But we also expect, do we not, that certain kinds of genre films and sequels and blockbusters, audiences are probably going to like those movies more than the critics did.
Right.
For example, critics, 85% of them liked Upgrade, but 86% of the audience liked it. Just as an example, right? Let me look at the numbers on the Ocean's 8. I don't know if I wrote that one down, but that would have been interesting. That would have been telling. But even like Won't You Be My Neighbor, the Mr. Rogers one, 99% of critics like it, 99% of audiences like it.
Right. That's awesome.
So for a genre film to have such a drop-off in terms of audience enjoyment of it, what does that mean? And that's something I want to talk about in the future. What can we make of movies where the spread between critics liking a movie so much more than audiences have to say about the films, about how they're marketed, and all of this,
because I do think criticism,
but I do think, because I do think it ties in directly to how they're marketed, that in some way audiences have been set up for something they're not getting and it makes them mad. There is another art house film, an art house film that has been pushed as an art house film by one of the legendary filmmakers of all time, that we'll talk about when we talk about this, and the critics gave it an 85% positive. And the audiences that went to see it, 22%. And and these are art house audiences who knew they were seeing an art house film, and they hated it.
Okay.
So this is an intriguing thing to me that I feel is kind of a modern phenomenon. So maybe we'll talk about it in the weeks to come.
Let's talk about that.
All right.
I look forward to that.
Until then. Okay. I'm Phil Lernis, and you can find every installment of your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour at chillpackhollywood.com. Download them, stream them, subscribe via iTunes.
Even write a review.
That's Dean Haglin, who's going to let you know how you can write us.
Please write us at chillpackhollywood@yahoo.com, like so many people do, which is what we mean when it says it's your Chill Pack Hollywood. And Phil, where do we find us on the Twitter and the Instagrams?
We are at Dean and Phil. Spell out the word and. Please like us, won't you, on Facebook?
Yes, we're at facebook.com/chillpackhollywood. What else is there to say?
I think that's it.
That's it.
Other than to say that until next time, I'm Phil Lernis.
I'm Dean Haglin.
Belated spoiler alert.